Today in lecture, we are going to move on to the next chapter. I know you may still have questions from the Acid Bates chapter, and there are a couple of small topics I'm going to catch up on. And yes, I am wearing a Cookie Monster shirt because I just felt like it. Because yes, C is for Cookie, and that's good enough for me. I mean, everything I ever needed to know, I learned when I was in kindergarten, right? That's what they always say. Well, okay, C is for chemistry, but cookies involve chemistry too, don't they? Ah. So anyways, as is much of my life right now, let's talk about entropy today. And I'm not in a classroom like I normally would be, and I don't have a traditional chalkboard at home. And the whiteboard that I had is sitting in my office. So imagine, if you will, that I had two chalk erasers. And if I clapped those erasers together, what would you expect would happen? Dust. Everywhere, right? If I were to hold the two erasers out, is it possible that all those particles of dust will collect back together again on the chalk erasers? Wow. No. Well, yes, it is possible. There is a mathematical possibility. There's no chance in the lifetime of this universe that that would likely happen, because if it did, well, then I just blew my cover, you know, secret chemistry. I mean, yeah, why would you choose to be a chemist? Because nobody would guess that you're really, you know. But no, it's not going to happen. Because there's too many other probable outcomes. And that's really the way of thinking of entropy. Entropy, the word typically is interpreted as disorder. But it's more than that. It's that things want to spread out. When I say things, that means both matter as well as energy. I was reading the book this morning, and it was kind of amazing because I was reading through it thinking, crap, I've got to do this chapter again. And I say that because this is always the chapter I feel like I am the least competent in. You're like, oh, great, thanks for setting us up for failure here. But I read the chapter, and I put it down, and it's like, you know, something happened, that one neuron fired, that it's like, that's what it is. Because the way I just described it really is what entropy is. It's the idea that there are all these possible ways that particles can move around and interact and do whatever. And it's not that they can't come together. It's just like someone said, highly unlikely. Things, I'm going to use the buzzword, don't tend to spontaneously gather together. They tend to spread out. And so if you have different energy states, different ways that molecules could all occupy space, they were all the same energy. Well, the ones that are more likely are the ones that are going to be the ones that happen. And that's entropy. Now, when we start putting math to it and concepts to it, that's where even I in the past, you know, never really got it in some ways. And now I think if I can explain it to you all, that would be great. But if I can put it on paper, but I think I get what the book's trying to do. So I'm going to follow along on the book this time. Not so much because I'm cheating, but more that I get the progression that it's going through, how it's dealing with this thing that's called entropy. And the first thing it starts out with is this. We know that ice melts, right? So imagine that we had this. Let's say we had a isolated system. And what that's going to mean is there's no energy change possible for the system. That's what isolated means. Somehow magically sealed off from the rest of the universe. But that doesn't mean that things can't happen inside of it. So let's say that we have liquid water and floating in it, we have a hastily drawn cube of ice. And let's say that the water is at a comfortable 25 degrees Celsius. And the ice, what's left of it, is right at 0 degrees Celsius. What's going to happen? Come on, humor the guy with the Cookie Monster shirt. The ice will melt. Okay, so what you're saying is that there's an energy change where we have the water, whatever heat is entering the water or leaving the water because it's going to the colder spot, and then we have the heat of the ice, and those are going to add up to zero. Because the systems want to reach equilibrium. Sure. Why can't the ice form again? Because if it adds up to zero, you know, we could say that the ice melts, the heat goes from the water to the ice, and that adds up to zero. But couldn't heat go from the what was the ice back to the water, which means we make more ice? Because that still adds up to zero, doesn't it? Right, okay. This is, what, the first law of thermodynamics? I remember a chemistry teacher trying to explain it in terms of you can't win, you can't break even, you can't get out of the game. And I didn't really get it, and I think it's still a little bit weak part of it, but what is this, you can't win? And if you'd ever heard that phrase before, it's something that comes up in some context. You can't win. You can't break even, and you can't get out of the game. It means like, well, yeah, anyways. First law of thermodynamics says it can't win. You can't create energy from nothing. Energy changes in isolated systems are equal to zero. So I'm going to go back up here and label this as the first law of thermodynamics. And what we're presented with here is the problem that the first law of thermodynamics cannot explain why ice... Oh, that's a double negative. This is proof positive, isn't it? Let me see if I can reword that. The first law of thermodynamics cannot explain why ice not only melts, but also forms. Since in an isolated system, both phase changes would automatically have an overall energy change, of zero. Again with the references. I was waiting, actually, after I said isolated system, isolated from the rest of the universe, I was waiting for some new Doctor Who reference of the cube, which if you even know what I'm talking about, you already know. And if you don't, well, then spoilers. So, what's wrong? We need the second law of thermodynamics. And, well, okay, we're way too early for that, I think. Let's see, where is that in your chapter? Yes, so we got a little talking before we get there first. Because let's talk a little bit more about this entropy concept. Because one really useful thing to think about is phase changes. Like, just to get conceptually more what entropy is. So remember back, didn't we do it at the beginning of this quarter as well? We talked about solids, liquids, and gases, right? Because we had the phase change and the phase change diagrams and the heating curves and all that. So we went through where solids were condensed phases, where matter generally has some kind of crystalline form. Then we have liquids, where the molecules are randomly arranged, but still condensed. And then we have really spaced out matter, which is gas. Well, what would you say would be the entropy of each of these systems? And not like which one would have more entropy, which one would have less entropy? And if you don't, gas has most entropy. Yes, yes. So a gas has more entropy than a liquid, which in turn has more entropy. Than a solid. This is because a gas has freedom of movement. And therefore more ways energy can be distributed. And I mentioned heating curves, and I remember a question someone asked in office hours, and that was part of the light bulb moment that I had when I was reading earlier today, is that I guessed accidentally the right answer, and now I understand how I got it correct, because there must be some little bit of entropy back in the back of my head that I've got left over from when I took chemistry. So this was just sort of a practical example to explain the concept of entropy, because I did the thing where I talked about clapping the erasers together. And that gives the idea that matter wants to spread out. Well, which phase of matter can spread out? A gas. So a gas has higher entropy because it has more ways the molecules can be distributed, which also is going to mean that there are more ways that energy can be distributed. And in fact, it's dealing with gases that's one of the major examples of the first section of this chapter. But before we get to that example, I want to talk about something that's shown here that I talk about every quarter that I can, that's appropriate. Because there's this picture in the text where it shows a solution being prepared, and then it puts this beaker on top of a little puddle of water, and then that water ends up freezing and the beaker sticks, therefore, to it. And it's because of the reaction that's going on. And it's a case of this. Have any of you ever heard of Epsom salts? And let's see, I've got my formula right. Yep. It's another word for magnesium sulfate. So magnesium sulfate, if you put it into water, will form an aqueous solution. Now, when that occurs, the solution gets cold. Kind they use in bath bombs. I don't know if they're in bath bombs or not. I think that's some mixture of bicarbonate and citric acid or something like that in order to cause the bubbly thing that happens. But I know that they're used sometimes for soaking. And I don't remember what the medical purposes are, but I've heard of people using Epsom salts. And the solution gets cold is what happens. And why would that be? What would we describe that as? From the perspective of magnesium sulfate dissolving, would that be an endothermic reaction or an exothermic reaction? Well, see, remember, exothermic means to release heat. But if the reaction was releasing heat, wouldn't the solution get hotter? And so, no, it must mean that from the perspective of the reactants, you know, separate from the whole solution, the reactants themselves must be absorbing energy as they dissolve, because that's why the solution's getting cold. So let me write that out in English form. When magnesium sulfate dissolves, the solution becomes cold. Meaning that heat is absorbed from water. As the solution forms. And that means it is an endothermic process. If it's endothermic, which means it absorbs energy, why does it happen? One word answer. Yes, why does this process happen? Bingo! Entropy! We have a winner. This process can occur because the entropy change outweighs the enthalpy change. Wait, what does that mean in English? Well, you're making a solution, right? Magnesium sulfate was a solid. It would make sense that the solution has much more entropy than the solid, because now all the ions can go running around however they want to. So since a solution allows for far greater distribution of matter and energy, forming a solution involves a large positive entropy change. Which has an energetic effect that makes up for the fact that heat must be absorbed for the process to occur. Dr. Gray, you said you were going to translate this into English. This is just longer chemistry. Okay. Think of my office, if you could imagine my office, which those of you who are my students before, there's those days where I spend some time, some considerable time, so that the piles get smaller and the dust bunnies get turned into like little dust bugs instead of dust dinosaurs, like what really exists under my desk. So, you know, you can see that there's an effort made to clean the office. And then about half an hour later, it's... you know, entropy at work, right? So the fact that it makes a mess is a release of energy itself. Matter and energy spreading out is a release of energy itself. And we've never talked about this. What is the difference between enthalpy and entropy? Okay, so I was leading up to that. I'll take a first stab at it. Enthalpy is kind of like heat, which means it is a raw transfer of energy from one place to another. That energy comes in the form of the sum of all translational, vibrational, rotational motion of all the molecules in that, or atoms, or whatever is there. It's how everything's wiggling around. That's what heat is transmitted as. Suppose that you have a system that undergoes no chemical reaction, but all that changes is how the molecules are spread out. It turns out that that has an energetic effect, which means there's heat involved, but there's no reaction going on. You're not changing the identity of the reactants or the products. You're changing its state. So that's leading us very nicely into our next example, actually, which is about gases, which will maybe start to make some of this make sense. At least I hope. So let me see where I am according to the text. Yes. Okay, so it does throw the math in. And I have to go back and read my advanced chemistry text to understand where this equation comes from. Because I can look at the equation and I have an idea and I can't quite put my finger on it. But it's a little bit like the graph, you know, energy distribution diagram, having an exponential function in it, which you can then turn around as a log function if you wanted to in other contexts. So that energy distribution graph is usually called, or one of the kinds of them, is a Boltzmann distribution. And that same Boltzmann came up with this equation. Put a mathematical face to equilibrium. Not equilibrium, what am I talking about? To entropy. Different chapter. Well, equilibrium is connected to entropy. We're going to come back to that. So what does this equation mean? Well, the W, for reasons that I'm not sure, presumably by the name Boltzmann, I would guess was German or Austrian, and therefore W starts probably a German word beginning with W, but it's the number of possible configurations of energy. The buzzword used is microstates. So if a state is a description of this, of the energy of a system, let's say. But what if there were multiple ways that energy could be distributed that was, that they were all equivalent? So if you had these different ways, those are each called a microstate. So individual ways in which the same amount of matter or energy can be distributed in a system. And then K is the Boltzmann constant. Which, this is the part that made my mind go, oh, because I know that there's some deeper meaning for this. So there's the thermodynamic constant R, and you divide it by Avogadro's number, 6.022 times 10 to the 23rd, and that equals K. So it's somehow the gas constant pops up in this equation. So that makes me desperately now want to know, how is the gas constant really derived? Because then that's all related still to entropy. Now, before we get too lost in the story, let me back up and kind of summarize, because I can tell I'm losing focus a little bit because it's so many threads of thought going on at the same time. Entropy is an explanation for why ice melts and it doesn't freeze. Because when ice melts, energy gets spread out. And that is a likely probable event. There are not as many events, not as likely going to happen, that you're going to constrain that energy back into a more contained state. When you let a system expand like that, when ice melts, by creating more freedom of movement, you create all these different microstates. And to shrink that back down, it's effectively cost energy. And letting it expand out effectively releases energy. So we talked about solids and liquids and gases because we talked, that's some physical way, kind of thinking what entropy is, a level of disorder. More meaning of ability to spread energy around. And then this is a second example I was talking about, where you take some salts like magnesium sulfate and put them in the water, they will dissolve, but it's an unusual or it seems like a conflicting thing for it to do, because then water gets cold. Well, that means that heat is leaving water. Why? Because it's being distributed as entropy. It's being used effectively to distribute this energy and matter around. Because doing so is something favorable on its own. Matter and energy spreading out is a release of energy itself. Now, so we're going to have this mathematical approach to measuring or talking about entropy. And later on, we're going to come up with a more physical way of doing it. And the results are going to end up being the same. And the reason we talk about both is this is the more theoretical, dealing with numbers of molecules. But entropy is technically something that could be measured in the absence of chemical reactions. It is a bit of thermodynamics that can exist without molecules. So that's why there are two stories. There's this, which is what is known as statistical thermodynamics, where they went in and mathematically tried to create systems that explained observations. But then there's this whole science of thermodynamics that was able to be developed without even knowing atomic structure, technically. And so there's this effort to unite the two pictures. That's why you've got two stories in your text. So, what is this equation about? And what is this number of microstates thing? Let me do the exact example that the book does. And the book does this. It says, let's go to a gas phase. And let's start with the simplest system possible. Let's say that we have a single gas molecule. So I'm going to replicate exactly the presentation in the text because it gives us different examples and it comes up with the value of W for each of these examples. So let's say that we have a container that has two chambers that is separated by a valve. And so in this side, it's closed. Similar picture here, where the valve is now open. Let's say we have one particle of gas, and we'll call it A, just like the text does. Well, how many different ways can A be distributed when this valve is closed? Well, there's only one way to distribute it, because it's only got one container. So we could call that our one reference state, only one place the molecule can exist in. But if we open the container, and remember that there are two halves, well, the molecule could now be in one half, or it could now be in the other. And that would be two possible states, which is 2 to the first. So again, that's the new W. Now, instead of drawing these little curvy things, I'm going to simplify the picture to make it faster to draw. So now let's say that we had a chamber that had two gas molecules in it. And again, this line here that I'm now drawing separates open versus closed. So now, if we open this up, there are four unique ways A and B can be distributed in the system. They could stay where they are. You could have A on one side, B on the other. You could have it backwards, B on one side, A on the other. Or they could both move to the other side. Now, in this case, it's kind of interesting because that means that it's just as likely that the molecules will stay together as they will spread out. But if you look at the total number of states, There's still only one way that you can distribute them on the left because they're still closed. What is the blue again? That's highlighting W, the number of possible ways that energy can be configured, the number of microstates. So now we get four possibilities, which ends up being 2 to the second power. And notice that's because we've got two molecules. Now, what if we just step this up by 1? Well, now we're going to have 3 molecules. So we'll call them A, B, and C. There's still only one way they can be configured when you have the box closed off. You open it up, change the space that these things have to bounce around in. Now there becomes suddenly 8 possible states. And these would be the following: A, B, C in one, A, B in one, C in the other, A, C in one, B in the other, B, C in one, A in the other. Then we have A, B, and C on this side. We have A, B on this side, C on the original. We have A, C on this side, B in the original. And then we have B, C in this side with A still in the original. A little bit more complicated set of states. And you can see that the number of states now where everything stays together. So there's only this state and this state where everything stay together. Now there's far more states where the molecules want to spread out. And notice that the number of configurations is now 8, which is 2 to the third power. So there's a direct connection between how many molecules there are and how many microstates there are. So in general, and sorry if you needed screenshots, I must have had extra tea this morning. I can tell I'm moving a little quickly. At least it seems that way. So in general, if there are n molecules in this gas example, there are 2 to the n microstates created by doubling volume. Okay, so what does that mean? Well, then the book goes math again. So I will try to translate. This may be a translation between math and chemistry, which is not as satisfying as math and English. But an important concept: entropy is a state function. Meaning that the number of ways matter and energy can be distributed depends only on the state the system is in. not how the state formed. So in other words, a brick of ice, see, so, oh, I'm sorry, I'm seeing, I'm not catching up with my chat window today. Oh, hold on, sorry. Got that one. Oh, yeah. Got that one. Oh, yeah, good grief. Endo, exo, what is the difference between, oh, yep, a number of things. Oh, okay. Someone's asking if I did the same example and the volume tripled instead. I can't think that fast. Okay, that took the one little brain cell that was holding this revelation I had this morning that was holding all these ideas together. That just broke that brain cell, unfortunately. So, back to what I was going to say here. Entropy, let me repeat it so I can get my context back. Entropy is a state function, meaning that the number of ways matter and energy can be distributed depends only on the state the system is in, not how the state formed. Which means this. So the initial entropy of this gas example is K natural log of W, which is K natural log of 1, which is going to be equal to 0. And then we get that the entropy of the expanded system is going to be what? Well, it's going to be K to the natural log of W, which is equal to K times natural log of 2 to the n power. Now, it then does some more math, and it comes up with what the actual number would be here. But the point is, it looks like it's going to be a huge number. But because it's a log, it somewhat cancels out. So, as an example, for one mole, where n is equal to 6.022 times 10 to the 23rd, then S equals 5.76 joules per Kelvin. And I'll talk about a little bit later why it's joules per Kelvin. Excuse me, what moment? Computer needs juice.
J over K, K is Kelvin, right?
No, the little k here, no, it's the Boltzmann constant. In the units, the K is Kelvin, yes. So, and this is not rate constant either. This is the Boltzmann constant. So, and I didn't link these two thoughts together. The change in entropy is the final minus the initial, but the initial is zero relative to the frame that we're talking about. So I'm going to run out of time to get here, but this is where I wanted to go next, is the large scale definition of entropy. In other words, coming up with true physical measurements and relating them to entropy. So because we're going to run out of time, let me give you the equation we're going to work to. That the change of entropy in the system is going to be defined as this. The reversible heat divided by temperature. I'm sorry, that is 5.76. Let me give you the short version of the story that it uses to come up with this equation. And I'm going to go into this in more depth next time. Just for those of you who are going to now dive into the chapter to try to understand all this mess, here's the next thing it does. It says, imagine you've got a gas cylinder. And on that gas cylinder, you have a beaker or a pile of sand. And so that's a weight pressing down on this piston that's here. And inside of that, you have some sort of gas. Now imagine that you were to double the volume of this container, exactly like what we were doing up in the example before. So in the example, we just magically opened a valve and then the volume doubled. And that was to be able to do this statistical approach of how many ways would the molecules now be arranged and what can we make out of that mathematically. This is a way of describing how you could do it physically. You might say, well, why don't you just lift it up and double it? That's the part that gets really difficult. And that's the part I still got to read up on. Because that's the one little detail I'm still missing in my head. But when you do things in an infinitesimally reversible way, that means this. That in this pile of sand, you take one grain of sand out with little microscopic tweezers, and you do it one at a time, very slowly, very carefully, and so that the system just expands, the gas expands. And this is kept constantly at the same temperature. So you can imagine this infinitely big water bath that this container is in to keep the temperature of the whole system the same. As you're removing one grain of sand at a time, if you didn't have energy going into the system, PV equals NRT, and you know that as the gas expands, pressure, volume, temperature. That either the pressure is going to give or the temperature is going to give. Well, we keep the temperature the same, and then take the weight off, you're going to have the same pressure. You're just going to have a volume expansion, but that's coming at the expense of heat through temperature. I think I just garbled that a little bit. But the point is this. It has to absorb energy in to be able to fight that or just to have that volume change just by that sand being taken off. That amount of energy being absorbed in is due to entropy. So this Q reversible, that's the amount of energy that would be necessary to do this reversible process. And when you divide it by the temperature this all occurs at, that's equal to the entropy of the system. And the number ends up being exactly the same as what you calculate statistically. You might be thinking, what the hell is all this for? So you know that I keep flashing this delta G up, and I talk about it being energy. It's a measure of entropy when you really get down to it. It's a way of talking about how or why chemical reactions happen. Because to summarize everything we've done today, processes that happen all by themselves, water melting, chalk floating off into the air, chemistry instructors babbling about chemistry, all of it's predicted by whether entropy of not just the system, but the whole universe, whether entropy increases or not. And that is the second law of thermodynamics.